Immigrants and U.S.-born Latinos account for the fastest-growing segment of the local workforce. They also account for more than a third of uninsured people in Kansas City, based on a look at the data coming from the three largest counties in the metro, Jackson County, Johnson County, and Wyandotte County. That's according to a recent study that we'll be hearing about today on KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman. Here to discuss it is Randy Capps. He's the co-author of the study, and he's joining us from the Migration Policy Institute in Washington, D.C. He's the director of research for U.S. programs there. Hi, Randy.
Good morning, Gina. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Doing great. Thank you.
Before we dig into your findings, could you explain what this study was, by which I mean what you were looking at and why?
Sure. We collaborated with Kansas University Medical Center, and we were charged with looking at access barriers to immigrants and Latinos in the healthcare system in the Kansas City metro area. So our part of it at MPI was to look at data on the populations of immigrants and Latinos in the area and also their health insurance coverage. KU Med's part of it then was to interview some of the immigrants in the area and talk to them about various healthcare access barriers.
So you conduct research in your job just all over the U.S., and I'm curious what caught your attention about healthcare access for Latinos and immigrants specifically in Kansas City.
Kansas City is an interesting area because it's a combination of different kinds of issues. If you look at Kansas City, Kansas, it's a very high concentration of lower income people there, with a large majority of the uninsured there being immigrants and Latinos. A lot of them actually are unauthorized immigrants from Mexico. And it's kind of a low resource environment because it's a relatively less affluent community. Then you have Johnson County, Kansas, which is a much more affluent and larger suburban jurisdiction, where there are a lot more resources, where there's a better, if you will, better economic opportunities. But you have almost as many uninsured Latinos and immigrants there. They're just more dispersed throughout the population and less concentrated than in Kansas City, Kansas. And then Kansas City, Missouri, you have another urban area, but it's an area in which there's a much smaller share of Latinos and immigrants among the uninsured. So it's interesting how different the population dynamics and insurance coverage dynamics are in those three different areas.
And that stands out to you when you look at that in comparison with what you see in other cities throughout the U.S.?
It does, because Wyandotte County in Kansas City, Kansas has a lot higher share of immigrants and Latinos, particularly unauthorized immigrants, again, from Mexico, than the national average. So it's a bit different than a lot of the rest of the country and a lot of the rest of the Midwest. Kansas City, Missouri, and the Johnson County have a much lower average and are probably more typical for the Midwest.
Why does how concentrated versus how dispersed the Latino and immigrant populations are, why is that significant to you?
Well, a lot of what we were trying to do with this research is to provide information to help health providers in the area to plan, right, and to be able to provide services to the populations where they are and based on their needs. And so the high concentration in Kansas City, Kansas, really provides a base for services for community health centers, even though the funding, again, it being a less affluent jurisdiction, makes the funding and the support a little weaker there than in other parts of the metro area. Having a highly concentrated population means a lot of people can walk to a clinic or take a short bus ride there. It's more challenging when you get out to the suburbs. When you get out to Johnson County, there are large populations that are uninsured in Olathe, Lenexa, Overland Park, but it's a greater distance that they have to travel to get to see the doctor. And that creates different challenges, right? It makes it a little bit harder for the community health centers to reach out to these populations. It makes it a little harder to provide the right transportation and schedule appointments and those kinds of things.
Tell me about the local organizations you partnered with on this.
Sure. Well, the primary partner was Juntos, which is a health promotion and outreach organization that's run out of Kansas University Medical Center. And they in turn linked us with a number of the federally qualified health centers and other community health resources in the area. For instance, the Vibrant clinics that are in Kansas City, Kansas, as well as some of the larger hospitals such as Mercy in Kansas City, Missouri.
Did you, I mean, you're talking about clinics being exactly where you say there is a need for them. Did you find that, that those were like viable interventions in the problem that you're describing, which is a lack of access to insurance?
Well, it's tricky because the financing of these federally qualified clinics depends on having some patients who carry health insurance. And those patients that carry health insurance help support the other patients that don't have health insurance. And really the key to that is Medicaid. And so if you have an area where you have a lot of unauthorized immigrants who are not eligible for Medicaid, or you have a lot of single adults that aren't eligible for Medicaid because there hasn't been an expansion for them under the Affordable Care Act, you have large, low-income, uninsured populations. They're mostly adults. The children are much more likely to carry insurance. And so balancing that, getting enough paying patients to offset the patients that don't have health insurance can be difficult, particularly in Kansas City, Kansas, where you have this high concentration of uninsured Latino immigrants.
So I want to dig into what you found out really specifically with this study. What did the data alone tell you? This was based on census data, right?
Yeah, the American Community Survey is done every year, and it's a pretty strong sample at the county level. And we looked at the trend and the size of total size of Latino and immigrant populations, and they've been rising very, very rapidly.
Can I just jump in here and clarify, when you say Latino and immigrant populations, what exactly are you describing there? Because when you say immigrant, specifically Latino immigrant populations or immigrant populations writ large?
Right, and I'm sorry if that's a little bit confusing. There's Latino populations writ large, and there's immigrant populations writ large, and then there's an intersection between the two, right? So you have immigrants, say, from Mexico and Central America, that's most of them. They're immigrants, but then their children, if they're born in the United States, are not immigrants. So that's most of the rest of the Latino population that is not technically immigrants, is children who've been born to Mexican and Central American immigrants in the area, and they're... some of them are still children, and a lot of them are grown up and of working age now. So that's the larger Latino population.
And so then, you look at these two separate populations to get a sense of the crossover, that crossover point.
That's correct.
And
on the other hand, if you get out to Johnson County, you have a lot of immigrants who are not from Mexico, Central America, other Latin American countries, particularly the larger Asian countries like China and India.
So it is my understanding, though, when we talk about the census, that the census does not always reflect complete information about populations that for one reason or another would prefer to fly under the radar. You've said that you have counted what you call unauthorized immigrant populations in this study. Seems like that would be a population, though, that's hard to track via census, or am I wrong about that?
Well, a lot of researchers have tried to look at that. They've tried to, say, measure likely unauthorized immigrants from Mexico that are probably counted in the American Community Survey in the census, compare that with records in Mexico of how many people were born there and how many people have left or come back. And most of the estimates are that the census, the ACS, does a pretty good job. They might miss maybe 10 to 15%. And we build that into our estimates. We do we build in some undercount. The other thing is that the Census Bureau has gotten pretty good at finding housing units. So their basis for analysis is, okay, here's a house or an apartment. How many people live in it? If they can't get that information directly, then they'll ask the neighbors or they'll use other ways to try and impute who's in it. So it's not an exact science. Some people are not counted. But I believe, and other researchers believe, it's probably maybe 10 to 15%, at most 20%, that are missed.
And the picture of Kansas City when it comes to access to health care and insurance, when you're looking specifically at immigrant populations and U.S.-born Latino populations, is what? How would you describe that picture?
Well, it's been improving. If you look nationally, and this is true in the Kansas City area as well, before the Affordable Care Act, before 2014 and after, there's been a big jump in the number of people who get health insurance through both private sources and through Medicaid and other public sources. So there's been some improvement, but there's still a big gap between Latinos and immigrants and the rest of the population. They're much more likely to be uninsured. Part of that is the unauthorized immigrant population. They're not eligible for any form of public coverage in the Affordable Care Act, Medicaid, or otherwise. They're also more likely to work in lower wage jobs that don't carry health insurance. So they're much more likely to be uninsured than other groups. And it's where you have the largest numbers of unauthorized immigrants. Again, that's Kansas City, Kansas, in this metro area. That's where you tend to have the highest uninsurance rates in the Latino population.
There was also, just stepping aside from the data, there was this whole experiential component of the study that went alongside the data-driven work you did. Is that right?
Yeah, no, my colleagues at KU Med ran some focus groups, did some interviews with providers and with immigrant families in the community. And, you know, they also discussed in more detail, okay, if someone does have health coverage, what are some of the other barriers there might be for them to get to see the doctor when they need to?
What did you hear from them?
Well, one of the big things is that even with Affordable Care Act coverage, it's expensive, right? People go to the doctor and they still have a significant copay that they can't cover everything that they need to cover. And that can convince them not to go back if they need expensive follow-up care. A second thing is that if they're uninsured, or even if they're insured and have Medicaid, but primarily rely on this community health center system, it's hard to get an appointment. And sometimes that appointment comes weeks, a month away. By the time the appointment comes, it's too late. They're already sick and had to go to the emergency room, or whatever symptoms they had have passed on, and so they don't think it's important to go anymore. Of course, language is an issue. Sometimes cultural misunderstandings about care and how to follow up in particular. Like if a doctor gives someone instructions after they've come to see them, they expect that the patient's going to follow those instructions pretty closely. And sometimes it's harder for immigrants, particularly when there are language barriers, to follow up on those instructions. And then there's also the issue of transportation. That, again, it's a bigger issue out in Johnson County in the suburbs. Unauthorized immigrants in particular can't get driver's licenses in Kansas, so they have to find some other way to get to the doctor. That's less of an issue if you get into Kansas City proper.
And what? Go
ahead. I was going to say one other thing, too, is particularly for uninsured people, is that this federally qualified health center network is pretty robust in most parts of the metro area, but it really provides that initial primary care, the initial doctor's visits. If people are really sick and need follow-up care, if they have to go, say, for a surgery, if they need expensive follow-up, like, say, dialysis, if they have kidney issues, that's harder to get for people who are uninsured.
What was most interesting to you about this entire study, about these findings when you put them all together, both the qualitative and the quantitative, and looking at Kansas City in the context of national trends?
Well, one thing that I don't think was a surprise, but is a little bit of concern, is that I mentioned earlier there's been a lot of progress in improving insurance coverage since the Affordable Care Act in 2014. And that stalled, right? So we don't see a decline in insurance coverage yet, but we see it kind of flattening out. And so that's one thing that I think is really important to keep in mind. The second thing that I think surprised me going into it was I was focused on Kansas City, and the suburbs in Johnson County have a lot of uninsured Latinos and immigrants also. And the insurance coverage rates for Latino immigrants in particular are almost as bad there as they are in the city. And so it kind of surprised me that you have this population in the suburbs that's also very needy. And that's where maybe more infrastructure needs to be built.
What do you think is the easiest aspect of all of this to potentially misunderstand or even misinterpret?
That's a good question. I mean, I think one thing that is easy to misinterpret is just because someone has health insurance coverage doesn't mean that they're going to get access to care. That's what KU Med found. And, you know, for all the reasons I described earlier, it's not just coverage. There's got to be doctors that are available. They have to be in a good location. They need to have that language and cultural competence so they can communicate with people, so people understand what they need to do when they go to the doctor. and it needs to be affordable.
Well, we will get right back to this conversation about Latino and immigrant healthcare access here in Kansas City. If you're part of the Latino community here, or if you work in healthcare and see this playing out in your work, we'd love to hear your perspective. 816-235-2888. We're talking about a recent study showing that Latino and immigrant populations account for a big chunk of Kansas City's uninsured. What that means for Kansas City when we return. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're talking about access to healthcare for Latino and immigrant communities here in Kansas City. If you're part of those communities, or if you work in healthcare and see the things we're talking about playing out at the ground level, we'd love to hear your stories. 816-235-2888 is the number to call. We're basing all of this on a recent study showing that Latino and immigrant populations account for a big chunk of Kansas City's uninsured. My guest is a co-author of the study. He joins us from the Migration Policy Institute in D.C. Randy Capps, welcome back.
Thank you.
To recap, for people who have just tuned in, what was it that the study found exactly?
Well, the study found that almost 40% of the uninsured population living in the three-county area, Jackson, Johnson, and Wyandotte County, were either immigrants or Latinos. And in Wyandotte County, which has the highest concentration, almost two-thirds of those who were uninsured were either Latinos or immigrants.
Two-thirds. That is significant.
Yeah, so
it's beyond significant.
Yes, if you're talking about the population that's in need of the community health centers and the other healthcare safety net providers, it's going to be predominantly Latinos and immigrants, and many are going to be unauthorized immigrants as well.
What does it mean for a city to have numbers like this? What are the implications?
Well, I mean, Kansas City, Kansas, you know, is a less affluent community. It is a community with lower housing costs. It's an area where, you know, and you see this in many metro areas across the United States. You see higher concentrations of lower income immigrants in certain places where they can afford to live. And when you have a small jurisdiction like Kansas City, Kansas, that, of course, affects the tax base, and that affects the ability to provide services like healthcare and other services.
I mentioned earlier in the show that we are also talking about the fastest growing segment of the local workforce. Why does that matter?
Well, it matters. I mean, a lot of information just came out about the most recent data from 2018 and the projections for 2019 that we have almost no natural increase in the population in the United States right now. That means basically as many people are dying as are being born in the country. In fact, most of the Midwest is ahead of that curve where there is a negative natural increase, if you will, where death
is. Negative natural increase.
Yeah, it's a natural decline, right? And so you need immigration or movement from other parts of the country.
Yeah, more people are dying. Fill,
more people are dying than more people are dying than being born. I mean, that's true throughout the rural Midwest, especially. Less true in the metropolitan areas, but again, nationwide, we're sort of reaching that point that a lot of other countries have reached, where our population would start to shrink, and our labor force would start to shrink if we didn't have enough immigrants coming in. And even if you look within that population, who's being born, the birth rates are higher in immigrant populations than they are in the longer term U.S. population. They're higher among Latino immigrants in particular. So that's why, you know, it's important the health and well-being of the Latino population, including that second generation, including the kids that are born here with immigrant parents, are going to be really big share of the increase in the labor force going forward.
So then what is, when that labor force doesn't have access to health care, what do you keep an eye on looking at that kind of pairing of situations?
Right. Well, I mean, the thing that, and it's not something that you can get from the census data, but the thing to look at is the health and well-being of children. Are they missing days in school because they're sick? Are they going to develop certain kinds of health conditions? Will they not get the education and the training and engage in riskier health behaviors? You know, we have a lot of issues in the country now with drug overdose. We've had issues in the past with smoking, and those kinds of things really lower life expectancy and lower productivity. They can keep people out of the labor force even at a very young age. And one of the crises that we have in the economy right now is we have a lot of people who aren't working, even though they should be, and they're in that working age group. And a lot of that has to do with poor health and substance abuse and poor mental health. And those are the kinds of things we don't want to see the next generation coming up. We want to see them healthier and more prepared to be working and be productive.
What are the questions that you're asking as far as policy goes as someone working for a policy institute?
Well, yes, the big question, of course, has been around improving healthcare access through the Affordable Care Act and through other means. Neither Missouri nor Kansas adopted the Medicaid expansion, which is optional under the Affordable Care Act. That means letting people who are adults below a certain income threshold get Medicaid. So both states have a pretty robust program for children, but they didn't take that option for adults. And that means there are more uninsured adults, some of whom are immigrants and Latinos, than in other states that have done that expansion. So that's one key thing. A second thing is that neither state has a program that covers all legal or lawfully present immigrants through Medicaid. Now, there aren't that many states that have that. You're talking about the bigger, more liberal states like New York and California. Fewer states in the Midwest do, though I believe Illinois does. And that would be a further expansion. What's not on the table, public policy-wise, and hasn't been, and it's probably unlikely to be for a while, is public insurance coverage for unauthorized immigrants. That was not part of the Affordable Care Act. It's never been part of Medicaid. And so when you're talking about that population and uninsured immigrants more generally, now you're talking about local policies. You're talking about funding for the public health clinics that people without insurance go to. You're talking about some foundation involvement. I mean, we worked on this project for Reach Healthcare Foundation, and they're very involved in this and shoring up the healthcare safety net. It's a matter of providing the funding to help build up community health centers that can serve people who are uninsured as well as those who are insured. And that, I think, is our main message, is that with the demographics of the population locally, there's going to be a substantially large and maybe even growing uninsured population that needs these kind of services.
You've said that, you know, there isn't any sort of precedent in the U.S. for giving access to insurance to unauthorized immigrants on a policy level. Are there countries that do that?
Well, a lot of countries have a universal coverage, and that will include recently arriving immigrants, regardless of their status. A lot of those countries, you also have to have an identification to do that. So people who are flying under the radar without identification may not get that. Now, I should say that there are states in the U.S. that have gone in that direction. So Massachusetts, for instance, even though unauthorized immigrants there can't get a full coverage like Medicaid, they can get a basic coverage that's basically allows them to go to certain clinics and hospitals and get reimbursed for certain services from the state. California is moving towards full coverage. They have coverage of unauthorized children there, and they've been moving towards coverage of certain groups of unauthorized immigrant adults. So parts of the U.S. have started to do this, but most parts of the U.S. don't. And there isn't really any activity in that direction at the federal government level.
How do you see any of this playing out when you're looking at health outcomes rather than access to health care? Do you understand what I'm asking there?
Yes, no, of course. And that's where the concerns around not just having health insurance coverage, but also having affordable coverage and being able to cover the ongoing really difficult health conditions like cancer, diabetes, things that are very expensive. Our healthcare system in the U.S. is extremely expensive, and it's hard for people, even with insurance coverage, sometimes to be able to afford that. Once they get these conditions, then people will be gradually becoming more and more disabled, come out of the labor force, and eventually they're going to present themselves at the hospital and emergency room, and it's going to be very expensive.
Are there follow-up questions that you are still asking going forward, things that you think it's important to know more about than even you currently do?
I think there are a lot of those questions. Those are the kind of questions that we've been coordinating with Reach Healthcare Foundation and KU Med about, the Juntos program there, which is taking a look at how can a system be developed given the constraints on insurance coverage and on financing that I already mentioned. How can that system best allocate healthcare across the area to the needy immigrant and Latino populations? And how can that healthcare also deal with these expensive ongoing health conditions in a way that provides the culturally sensitive care that immigrants and Latinos can understand, so they know what to do to keep themselves healthy and to deal with those more serious health conditions when they have them.
As you partnered with all these local organizations and the people who work for them, what concerns did you hear them expressing about the study itself, or just based on their own personal experiences of the issues it brings up?
Yeah, well, one of them was definitely the funding. One of them was that balance I mentioned earlier between having enough insured patients to offset the uninsured patients. That's been a real challenge for a lot of the community health centers. A second one has been being able to locate providers in the areas where you have rapidly growing immigrant populations, for instance, in the suburbs in Johnson County.
What do you mean by that, though? Locate providers?
Oh, to have a health center that is close enough to those new immigrant and growing immigrant communities that immigrants can access them. It's, you know, the more traditional or longer term health providers are located in the Kansas City, Missouri. They have a presence there. That's historically where there've been the most immigrants. Now that there are more immigrants moving out to the suburbs, it's more challenging. You know, new clinic spaces have to be built, or mobile clinics have to be designed, or transportation has to be provided to bring people to where the clinics are. And that's a challenge.
And so this sort of history of assuming, and with some basis, that these kinds of clinics belong predominantly in Wyandotte County, that Johnson County, for example, needs them too.
That's correct. And I would say another challenge for the providers is always the language and interpretation. That's difficult. There are some bilingual Spanish-speaking health providers, but there are not enough. They tend to be in high demand. Finding community interpreters, you know, if you're going to interpret for healthcare, particularly for mental health, it's not the same thing as just interpreting for a basic service like, say, a driver's license test. It's complicated because there are medical terms that people have to understand.
No matter what language they're speaking.
Yeah, no matter what language. And if they're going to be interpreting, they need to be interpreting correctly, you know, and that's a challenge to find that. Once you move beyond Spanish, it's very, very challenging.
I would guess also that cultural belief systems surrounding wellness are, that those just differ from culture to culture, and that some sensitivity to that would be required.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's explaining to people why just a basic concept like why you have to finish a whole series of medications. You know, you'll get a certain dosage that you have to take over a certain period of time. The symptoms may subside, but you still need to keep taking that medication for the period it's been prescribed. Like, explaining why that's important to people can be challenging. You know, for instance, if you're overcoming an infection and you need to take medicine for that, you need to take enough to be sure that the infection doesn't come back. That may not be an easy concept for people to understand if they're not familiar, you know, with a modern healthcare system.
As you partnered, you know, I'm just curious about your sense of what, not just the challenges going forward, but maybe if there are sort of hidden opportunities for growth and improvement, or sort of bright spots that are also masked by the larger takeaway here?
Well, I think there are. I mean, again, you have this improvement in coverage through the Affordable Care Act. We don't know what direction that's going to go in at the national level. There are opportunities for both Missouri and Kansas to pass legislation to expand coverage through Medicaid. And there's also this very strong local network of community health centers and hospitals. They're very engaged on this topic. And there are a number of bilingual and bicultural providers. There's a large group of health promoters and outreach workers that I met with when I was there, that work through KU Med and others to try to get the word out. I mean, there's a lot of momentum right now and a lot of good local leadership to try to find solutions to expand access, you know, given the real resource constraints that are in place.
Randy Kapp, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me on, and have a great day.
You too. Randy joined us from the Migration Policy Institute in D.C. You can read more about the study he co-authored about access to healthcare among Kansas City's Latino and immigrant populations at kcur.org. Up next, a look at opera from a soprano's point of view. I'm Gina Kaufman. Don't go away. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and there's a show coming up in Kansas City with kind of a surprising name. It's called The Cult of the Soprano, and the woman behind the event is here to tell us what that means. Victoria Botero, good morning.
Good morning, Gina.
What does that mean, The Cult of the Soprano?
Well, the name, so the original name was actually a little racier. I read an article by an incredible musicologist named Susan McClary, and the article title was Soprano as Fetish. So that was actually the original title of the program.
That is a little racier.
And a friend of mine said, you know, I don't think that's a good idea. That might attract a different kind of crowd. But the more I read the article and then other journals and books around it, there is this idea of there's a cult following for sopranos. And I've always, you know, I've studied singing my whole adult life, have been aware of that history. And it's not...
What history are you talking about? Because this is, I think there's some backstory that people who really know this kind of music are familiar with, but most of us don't. So catch us up.
Well, it's actually two different kinds of history. So Cult of the Soprano, the title of the program, refers to this idea of following famous sopranos through history and going to their performances, you know, at opera companies all over the world and being really into them. And what I learned backing up in that original article, Soprano as Fetish, is that this starts more than 400 years ago in the late 16th century, where the Duke of Ferrara had a third wife and no heir. And he had to come up with an idea to entertain his very young wife and hopefully keep her alive so that she would bear him an heir. And she loved music.
What was the concern regarding keeping her alive?
Well, his first wife died under shady circumstances. Many think that he poisoned her. And his second wife died of tuberculosis. She didn't last for very long. And somehow a family allowed their daughter to become his third wife. So, and he had no heir. And if he did not produce an heir, then his family lands would go to the papal estates, which is actually what did happen. So it seems like what he decided to do was to bring in for the first time three women and professionalize them as singers and add them to her court as ladies-in-waiting. He made sure that they were not considered women of ill repute, so he married them off to his courtiers, and so they became noble women. But really, they had a job to do every day, which was they practiced for 4 to 6 hours a day. They worked with a composer who wrote specifically for these three women, and they sang to Margarita, the Duchess of Ferrara, and all of the Duke's friends that he would invite. And it became a special invitation to hear these three women who sang. And it
all sopranos?
All sopranos. All sopranos. And it became this thing where other courts were jealous of this now political power that the Duke of Ferrara had, because he had this girl band, so to speak, that was attracting all of these visitors. So within 10 years of forming the three ladies of Ferrara, there were courts all over Italy that had their own copycat groups. And so there was this incredible flowering of composition for the soprano voice, and that, so to speak, is this cult of the soprano, this sound that everybody wanted to hear, the high female voice.
Can we talk about that sound and what that sound is often used for in opera?
Yes.
Tell me, first of all, how you would describe the sound of the soprano voice as a soprano yourself.
Oh, that's a hard question. I mean, my first thought is it's beautiful. I've always loved, before I even sang, I loved listening to singing. I loved the beautiful sound of it. It's ethereal. To me, it's peaceful.
The casting around this voice is not always, does not always indicate that that's a widely shared view.
Right. So that's what surprised me as I started to study singing and to study opera. So this is a funny story. I remember before I even saw an opera on stage, my neighbors had a garage sale, and I picked up the Harvard Dictionary of Music for like 50 cents, and I started to read it. I am officially a member of the Nerd Club. So I remember reading the Harvard Dictionary of Music, and there were these really short descriptions of synopses of operas. And I remember reading them and realizing that the sopranos in all of these operas were really strange. They had, they were always dying of dramatic things or being killed or just dying for love.
More than is true of other characters in operas?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It always seems like it's the soprano who goes mad and has a goes crazy, as in the opera. They're called mad scenes, where, you know, it's usually towards the end of the opera. She's dying for love, or she's killed somebody and her mind goes off. And so she sings, you know, for about 15 minutes, this extremely high, really beautiful, virtuosic, crazy hard music, and she's crazy. Or she's going to kill somebody, like in Queen of the Night, where she's, you know, trying to hand her daughter a knife and demanding that her daughter kill someone. Or it's Alcina, where Alcina is a sorceress, and she is super angry because the man she loves isn't returning her affections, and so she's summoning the gods to give her the power to turn him into an animal.
You could make the argument that the operatic voice is dramatic, but among all the voice parts there are, the soprano voice can be the most extreme sounding. It has this way of accessing this sense of extremeness. So then it would make sense that soprano characters would be extreme characters?
Yes and no. It's true that the soprano voice can be trained to sing have the largest range, three, sometimes four octaves, depending on, you know, who you're working with.
Yowza.
So there's a lot in there. There are a lot of notes in there, and you have to justify those notes. Like, why would you sing a high E flat or E or F, as in Queen of the Night? You have to have a really good reason. You're not going to just be singing about, you know,
I was reading yesterday.
Right, I was reading yesterday, so I'm, you know, going to suddenly pop that out. So my thought is that composers went to these characters that just were extreme. However, at the same time, the tenor voice, which was developed after this era, so the tenor voice really starts to develop more in the in the 19th century, you get this more virtuosic writing for tenors. And they can sing high. But tenors are always singing about the woman they love. They're always kind of noble when they're singing that high. So there's a choice.
Tenderness there.
Right.
Okay, let's get specific with some of the arias people will be hearing in your show. Let's talk about the mad scene in Lucia di Lammermoor. Yes. Am I saying that right? That is a hard one.
Lucia di Lammermoor.
You do it better. Before we do that, what's this opera about?
Lucia di Lammermoor is an opera by Donizetti. It's from the mid-19th century. And in it, it's based on a book by Sir Walter Scott, a Scottish tale that is supposedly based in truth of a, it's kind of like a Romeo and Juliet story. Lucia is in love with Edgardo, but Edgardo is from the warring clan. She's not allowed to be with him. And she's forced to marry someone that her family chooses. And on her So they have the wedding, and then they leave the reception. And then the next time you see Lucia, she is often in an opera. She's staged walking down some stairs wearing a nightgown covered in blood and carrying a knife. And she has her mad scene because she has just murdered her groom.
Okay, we'll hear these separately. I'm going to start by playing the beginning of this mad scene. But it was very gentle and sweet sounding, and you would maybe think that that's all there was to it if you didn't know she was covered in blood.
Right. And that's Natalie Dessay, if I'm correct. That's a recording by Natalie Dessay. And that's the kind of thing, like, it's like you get these sounds in your ear of specific singers and you follow them. So Natalie Dessay's interpretation of Lucia is softer than when Maria Callas sang it.
Let's hear, though, what she sounds like later in the scene when things have escalated a bit more. As you say, we're listening to Natalie Dessay doing the mad scene in Lucia di Lammermoor. Lammermoor, I have trouble with that, I'm sorry. This is at the climax of this mad scene. What's happening right there? What's happening as this mad scene escalates? Like, what's the deal with this character? Why is she singing so high?
She's saying that this is the greatest moment of her life. Even though she's covered in blood and she's carrying a knife and she's just killed her groom, she is having this vision that actually she and Edgardo have married each other and she's in heaven.
That does sound crazy.
It does. And it brings thousands of people from all over the world love to watch that on stage and see and hear and listen to the recordings. The Met, I don't think they're broadcast here anymore. The radio broadcast, Saturday afternoon Met radio broadcasts, there was a cult following for that for all over the world. People, you know, sitting next to their radios listening to the opera. And now you can go to the movie theater and see the Met broadcasts. But if you have access to that in your local movie theater. But, you know, I was reading a book recently called The Queen's Throat by Wayne Kostenbaum, and that came out in the 90s. And he talks about this following of sopranos, how when he was a young man and just starting to get into opera, he had this obsession with a soprano named Anna Moffo, who was an American of Italian descent. And he writes, you know, I had to know what Anna Moffo sounded like in 1962 versus 63 versus 64. I wanted to know how her voice changed in her different recordings. That's the kind of cult we're talking about, of a following. And I'm not saying that that doesn't happen with the other voice types. I mean, no disrespect to my mezzo, you know, tenor bass colleagues or countertenor colleagues, but it's a little different with sopranos.
Do you have a theory about why?
You know, it's like being an athlete. It takes so much work to make that look effortless on stage. And in the way that we watch the Olympics, we are there to see, I mean,
it's a physical feat.
It's a physical feat, and it's so beautiful. It's otherworldly.
I do want to talk more about the characterization of the soprano, though, because I am really intrigued by this. I am curious about your thoughts about just how playing these characters has been for you as a real woman living in the real world, mm-hmm. sort of internalizing these roles, or at least imagining yourself in them in a really profound kind of way, reflecting on what these recurring themes might say about how women and their the most sort of like quote unquote feminine version of that voice, how that's perceived.
I'm so glad you asked about that, Gina, because it's something I thought about for a long time. When I did my undergraduate, I did my undergrad in DC at Catholic University, and it was my first time really digging into this music. And I had to come to terms with characters that to me personally didn't, it just, you know, when in Madame Butterfly, when she takes her own life, or when Gilda offers her own life so that her love, who has utterly betrayed her, but she offers her own life so that he can be saved. That's hard to take as a contemporary woman. I had to dig deep and understand that the understanding that I've come to is that these women are powerful in their own way, in their limited choices for their time, for the story that's being told. So I don't see these roles as something that I need to look down on or to excuse. I do think that particularly right now in this era, we can go back to these operas and look at them in a new way. I love the companies that are inviting directors and conductors who come in and have fresh eyes at the choices that these women have made and are putting on productions that reflect that and having outside events around the actual opera production itself to talk about these stories because they are really important.
Can you give an example of a company that has done what you're describing, how they did it?
Well, our own company right here, Lyric Opera of Kansas City, is run by a woman. And she has been inviting in female directors and other directors who are bringing in productions that are showcasing women in a new light so that it's not just, you know, oh, poor Lucia, or oh, poor Madame Butterfly. There's a new way of looking at it. We're also, and I honestly, I don't really work in opera anymore. And that's a lot has to do with just personal choices of it's hard to leave for a month when you have a child. I do mostly work in concert music with orchestras and chamber music groups as a soloist. And I work a lot with composers, and I'm grateful to work with a lot of female composers. The music that's being written now is a more empathetic and realistic version of a woman. And I still get to sing high notes.
Well, you given how has all of this influenced the way that you have organized the concert for this Friday, The Cult of the Soprano?
So the concert is more there's a full program of music. For me, though, when I produce a program, I get really excited about all of the research that I've done, and I try to find ways to share that. So as the audience is coming in this Friday, it's Friday at 7:30 at the 1900 building, as the audience is coming in, there will be slides and photographs of paintings of famous sopranos, of quotes, so that they get a background of what they're walking into. And in between the pieces of music, I'll be talking a little bit about what's like where we get to with this next piece of music and what's happening. And then I'm also bringing in, for example, it's about sopranos, but I'm bringing in a wonderful countertenor named Zachary Cope for one piece called Pur Timiro from an opera called L'Incoronazione di Popea to showcase how the countertenor voice, which was really reflects what the castrato sound, the high male sound, they were trying to imitate that powerful female voice, but in a male voice. So Zach and Kaylee Ates will be singing this beautiful duet. And then in the second act, the development of the soprano voice also led to violin virtuosity. And so we'll get a beautiful violin solo from Joel Dader.
imitation is the highest form of flattery. So when you're saying all these, the violins, the tenors, they're all imitating the soprano.
Yes, that's right.
That's pretty cool, Victoria.
Thanks, Gina.
Victoria Botero, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Victoria is a singer. She is a soprano, and she has organized a show called Cult of the Soprano. It'll be at the 1900 building this Friday. The show starts at 7:30, and you can find all the details at Eventbrite. Also, we talked about an opera called Lucia di Lammermoor. In the Lyric is performing that opera in March. I feel the need to share that the tagline is come for the wedding, stay for the funeral, and you can get info at kcopera.org. Everything we talked about here today will be at kcur.org/centralstandard by the end of the day. That's kcur.org/centralstandard. Tomorrow, you say Missouri, I say Missouri, but what's the significance of that in politics, and where do those two different pronunciations come from? Tune in to find out tomorrow at 10, and start the conversation now on Twitter. We are at kcurcst. This show is produced by Melody Rowell, Mackenzie Martin, and Noah Taborda. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to date's next.